ॐ सहना भवतु सहनौ भुनक्तु सह वीर्यं करवावहै तेजस्विनावधीतमस्तु मा विद्विषावहै ॐ शान्ति शान्ति शान्तिः। निद्रा न विद्या ग्रहणम् न विद्या, निद्रा न विद्या ग्रहणम् न विद्या, कृणाति किञ्चिन्न यथार्थबोधे, कृणाति किञ्चिन्न यथार्थबोधे, निद्रापदर्थ ग्रहणेतरा स्यात्, निद्रापदर्थ ग्रहणेतरा स्यात्, चिरेव विद्या विलसन्त्य शून्या, चिरेव विद्या विलसन्त्य शून्या। Nidra means deep sleep. Deep sleep, not vidya. Deep sleep is not knowledge. Okay. Grahanam, perception, things that are perceived when the mind is awake. Perceiving, perception, nividya, is not knowledge. Granati kinchit na yatartha buddhe. In the knowledge itself, in what is knowledge, yatartha, truly, in knowledge as it truly is, there is nothing perceived. No one perceives anything. Granati na granati means there is no, that one does not perceive kinshit. One perceives nothing. Nothing is perceived, we say in English. One does not perceive anything, literally. Okay? One does not perceive anything. Nidra, deep sleep, padartha, an object, grahana, so deep sleep, and the grahana, the perception of a padartha, of an object. Padartha literally means the meaning of a word. So if I say the word lamp, the meaning of the word lamp is the lamp. And so objects are called, the meaning of the word is the object or the actual thing that the word is referring to. So that's the artha, the meaning of the pada, of the word padartha. Where he says, neither nidra, deep sleep, nor the perception of any object, of the object of any word, the perception of an object, itra syat, other than that, other, itra means other than deep sleep, and other than the grahana, the perception of an object, is what we could say. That which is other than the perception, other than the deep sleep or the perception of deep sleep, is what? So he says, let me just go through the words and then I'll tie that sentence together more tightly. Chit, consciousness alone is knowledge. So chit eva vidya, consciousness, which is other than, which is different than deep sleep and different than the perception of an object, that consciousness alone is vidya, is knowledge. Vilasanti, it's a present participle for Sanskrit people in the feminine. Vilasanti, that which is itself shining, self-shining, and is ashunya, not a void. Not emptiness, not non-existence. Here, shunya is meant more in the sense of non-existence. It's not a void. It's not non-existent. Okay. It itself, it is self-shining. It's not something which is non-existence. Means consciousness is. Consciousness actually is. Right? And it is vilasanti. It is shining of its own accord. And that is the vidya. That is the knowledge. So that's his verse. It's a really, really important verse, actually. So let's just take a look. From the standpoint of you as an individual in this creation, you experience yourself from the standpoint of the what we call the jiva upadhi, from the standpoint of this body, mind, sense organs, you experience yourself as the knower, the seer, the hearer, the experiencer, the one who gains knowledge. And so, for instance, if I were to say, I see that painting. I can say, I am aware of that painting. I now have knowledge of the painting. Oh, this was the painting my friend told me about. Now I know the painting. And so since I know the painting, I'll say that because the painting is now known, I have knowledge of the painting. And so the knowledge itself is given to the painting. I can even say a painting knowledge, right? So the knowledge is always given to, as though I'm gaining knowledge, I'm accruing knowledge, I know this. Now this thing that I know, whatever it may be, now that is the knowledge that I've accrued. And now I know this. And now that is the knowledge that I accrue. You see what I mean? So the knowledge is always given over to or superimposed, or for now I'll say given over to or experienced as as being an effect of my perception or my relationship with an object of knowledge, right? With an object that I perceive. And so that means that knowledge itself is given to the object, you know. And then who am I, the subject? I am the knower of that knowledge which I've gained. Right? And so I have a knower, the act of knowing, and the object of knowledge. So the knower through sense perception or whatever going on in the mind, whatever function is going on in the mind, through that function, the knower knows the object. And once the object is known, that is what we call knowledge. Right? And so I'm accruing or gaining knowledge. See? So Ramana says right away, that type of perception is not knowledge. that isn't knowledge. We label it as knowledge, but actually what we're labeling as knowledge does not really belong to that object of perception. Knowledge is there, but the problem is that we're labeling the knowledge to that. We're giving that knowledge experience to the object itself. And so the object becomes equated with the knowledge. You see what I mean? He says, that's not how it is. Then he says, deep sleep, of course, is not knowledge. Right? Because in deep sleep, there is no subject-object relationship. So that's kind of an easy one, I think. I don't know why he starts with that. He says, deep sleep is not knowledge. Yeah. So do I think that when I go to deep sleep and there's no subject-object relationship, that should be the state of knowledge? Because actually, maybe you could say, why is he saying that? Maybe it's because once I say that a perception, any type of perception is not knowledge, then maybe we would say then, oh, okay, perception is not knowledge, then the absence of perception, as we have in deep sleep, where there's a subject-object, the subject-object know or known is in unmanifest condition, then that is knowledge then? Is that what you're saying? He says, no, I'm not saying that. Deep sleep also is not knowledge, nor is perception. So then the question is, where does knowledge abide? Where is knowledge then? What is knowledge? And so his next statement is, actually, in that which, he says, this yatharta, means in knowledge as it actually is, in what is truly knowledge, in the knowledge of what it actually is, one does not perceive anything. Nothing is perceived. Nothing is perceived, but then he says, and it's not shunya. And it's not a void. It's not nothing. If nothing is perceived, it's not deep sleep, nor is it any type of a perception, but it is not shunya. It is not a void. It is not non-being. Okay? It in fact is vilasanti. In fact, it is self-shining. Vilasanti means it's shining without being something which is illumined, and also not a void. It's shining of its own accord. It's vilasanti. That is what knowledge is. And what is that? That is chit. That is consciousness itself And consciousness itself has to be differentiated from the objects, the padartha grahana, the objects of perception, and from the deep sleep. So what has to happen, there's what he's pointing to here is what we call a viveka, a discrimination in your experience, because usually the experience of consciousness, not the objectified experience of consciousness, the self-evident, self-shining experience of me, of my own being, is going to be superimposed upon any vritti, any thought modification in the mind. And so now, let's take a look at that. If I have any thought in my mind, let's take it for a perception for now. So I have a perception of the painting through my sense organs. I now have a thought modification given to me through my sense organs, which are focused on that painting. And now I have now what we call a vritti, a thought modification of the painting. Right? And it, for you all, if you're looking at this, it could be a bookcase. It could be anything, any thought modification. When I have that thought modification, means through my sense or through the use of my sense organs, my mind has taken on the form of whatever I'm directing my attention to. That thought, whatever it may be, is known. The mind, by its very nature, you know, I can get into some detail a little later, but I'm going to do some shortcuts now. The mind, by its very nature, is what we call sattva. The very material of the mind is called sattva. Sattva means that the mind always enjoys consciousness by its very nature. It's kind of like saying that a mirror, by its very nature, by the very material of which it's made, will always reflect something. You know, as long as the mirror is there functioning, it's not covered with dirt, so it loses its mirrorness. Wherever that mirror is, because of the nature of the mirror material, it's a reflecting device. Right? Whereas a rock isn't. Right? So if I had a rock and I'm trying to hold it up, do you see yourself in the rock? You'd say no. Right? If I hold a mirror up, yes. Okay. So the mirror and the rock enjoy kind of a different quality in terms of the material out of which they're made. So here, if we're looking at when Vedanta analyzes the material of the whole nature of creation, there are three, it can be divided into three huge sweeps. One sweep is that which allows for knowledge or consciousness or known, for something to be known. Right? That which seems to embody, in a sense, consciousness or awareness. That material is what we call sattva. You can think of it as a mirror-like material. It's what we call sattva. And your sense organs and your mind, for all beings, not just for human beings, for all beings, even for plants that are able to react and respond to the environment, that ability to know, to respond through knowledge, to be able, through your sense organs, whether very limited in some plants and more limited creatures or in human beings, that which allows you to have a sense of knowledge or knowership, that material is called sattva. And it goes throughout the entire creation. For jivas, the sense organs and the mind are what you have available to you that are made of sattva. And that's why the sense organs, we use the sense organs to gain knowledge. We use the mind to gain knowledge, to know things, to experience things. Whereas other things like the rock, for instance, or the table and the rock don't seem to have sattva. We say they are tamas. The material for that they have is what we call tamas. They don't have that. They have the ability to be, but they don't have the ability to know or to experience themselves as a sentient being, because no sattva there. And rajas is the third material that they talk about, third quality of this manifest creation. Rajas is what is responsible for all activity. Okay. And so that being so, your mind and sense organs allow you to gain knowledge. That's the experience. This is known, this is known, this is known. Wherever I direct my mind or my sense organs or my means of knowledge, that vritti, that thought modification, gives a has in it a manifestation as though, or reflection of consciousness, as well as a reflection of whatever that mind is directed toward. Right? So here, if I'm looking there, what do I have? I have a painting. My mind takes on the form of a painting. That painting, because of the sattva, that painting is known, right? It is known. But now there's another interesting little thing here. The painting is known because it's in the mind, right? And then what is my relationship to it? I would say then that I am the knower of the painting. Why? Because I'm not going to identify myself as the painting. So the painting doesn't get the word. I don't say, I am the painting. That comes later. Later you'll be able to say, I'm the painting. But when you start out, before you don't, if you don't have any knowledge, you can't really say, I'm the painting. They'll think you have psychosis or something, you know? So here, when you have the thought in your mind, you'll say, the painting is known, and that I am the one who knows the painting. Why? Because in any thought modification that you have, these two elements are present to you. One is the consciousness, which the vritti, the thought modification, is enjoying, and the other is the namarupa, the name and form that the vritti is focused on through sense perception or whatever means of knowledge we're using. Or it could also be just the imagination that comes up in the vritti, or an emotion, whatever it is, that thought modification, that content is going to be known because it's taking place in sattva. And sattva enjoys consciousness as though reflects consciousness, manifest, is of the nature where consciousness resonates in it. So then we have now the known object, the known painting, and the consciousness which allows the painting to be labeled as known. But I'm not going to label myself as known, as the known painting. Let's look at it like this. So now we have known consciousness, which I'm not going to label myself as. I'm going to label myself as me, the knower, the conscious being, who has now come into relationship with the known painting. So now I am the knower, the conscious being, me. Everybody will say, are you a conscious being? Oh, yes, I'm a conscious being. What is your relationship to the painting? I know the painting. Why do I know the painting? Because I'm the conscious being, because of which the painting is known. And then, who is that conscious being? Okay. We don't tend to ask that. We just know. We don't tend to ask it until you become a mumukshu, you know. But why do you say it like this automatically without any thought? It's because there is in any vritti, there is the consciousness, right? The consciousness which is me, and the consciousness which is labeled as me and which is me, and the consciousness which is then related to the object in the vritti. And so what that means is that the consciousness that illumines this vritti is now bifurcated, in a sense, by another thought that we call the ahankara, or the I notion. The ahankara comes in to talk about the vritti, you know, to talk about me in relationship to the vritti. And what is it going to identify in that vritti? This thought, it's just another thought, comes in, and it says, I know this painting. But because it's going to identify with the consciousness, not with the object of consciousness. Right? So I become the knower in the vritti, because I identify with the consciousness, and then I identify the known object, right? The object of the vritti, as the known. And so what that means is that in any vritti you have, it gets divided into knower and known. Right? So now I have the painting, so I know the painting. Now I have, you know, the television. I know the television. Now I have the computer. I know the computer. Right? So the I keeps being consistently a knower in relationship to any given experience in the mind. Right? So knower requires is a type of doership. Right? Now look at the problem here with this knower. The knower requires the mind. The knower known, that's two. The knower requires the mind. What if you go to deep sleep? What happens to the knower? Right? The knower is not there in the time of deep sleep. Because in deep sleep, the mind is in unmanifest condition. It's in its causal state. And so in deep sleep, this knower-known dichotomy isn't there. You need the mind to wake up for that. And then when the mind is awakened, the ahankara is functioning. All of the thoughts are functioning. The ahankara, the I notion, can come in and do this bifurcation. I am the knower of this object, whatever I'm perceiving. Or I am the experiencer of the object. Or I am the seer of the object. Or I am the hearer of the object. Or where I'm identifying this particular means of knowledge that is allowing me to be the ER of whatever it is, the er of it, right? I'm the knower, the seer, the thinker, the giver, all of these things. But in deep sleep, that's not so. However, when you wake up from a deep sleep, then what do you do? The mind is now awake again. And then you can actually recall that deep sleep state and say, you know, because you're recalling an experience that the mind, the sattva, has when it's in an objecta causal condition. Now it comes awake again. And then you can say, you know, I was in deep sleep. At that time, nothing was happening. There was no subject. It's okay, Tibbs.
Is that door open?
Oh, yeah, you have to open the door. The food is in there. Yeah. So at that time, that subject-object relationship comes back again. And the mind, and you can start responding to your prior condition that you were not able to respond to at the time of deep sleep. That means the subject-object duality, you know, the knower-known duality, is something that actually takes place within the mind itself, within the mind and sense organs itself, right? The knower-known. Because if you go into deep sleep, that subject-object duality is gone. See that? So now, say, what if we analyze our experience a little differently, more realistically, actually, more true to the actual experience? What is really happening is using my sense organs, I have a thought modification. I have a thought modification of the painting. Then what is happening? The painting is the mind itself is, we could say, illumined by awareness. We have to say the mind is illumined in a sense, or the mind enjoys awareness, because the mind can also be in a condition in which it doesn't enjoy awareness, right? Like in the deep sleep, for instance. Or any object that you experience can be in a condition of not enjoying awareness, of not being known. You know? It's kind of like if I turn off this light, none of these objects, so we turn off all the lights, right? None of these objects are self-evident. All of these objects are illumined only because of the light. And the difference, I mean, this is a relative example, but the difference between something like the light and something like all of these objects is that for the light, I don't have to bring in another light to make it shine. It is self-evident, right? But none of these other things are. Without the light, they're not known. And so, here also, a vritti, first of all, the object of the vritti, the object of the thought modification is not going to be known without awareness. And for it to even shine in awareness, you need a mind that focuses on it, or it's totally lost in terms of being known, because there's no vehicle for which it to be known. Okay? But then the mind itself needs to be illumined. It itself is not a luminary. So look at it like this. It itself does not enjoy consciousness of its own accord. Think of what it would be like if it did. Just think of your experience. You have any thought. You have a thought comes into your mind, and you are aware of the thought. You can even say, I'm the knower of the thought. We'll accept that for the moment. I'm the sakshi, I'm the witness, I'm aware of this thought. Right? And the thought also has awareness. And it will say, yes, and I'm aware of you too. There's two of us then. There's the self-effulgent thought, which enjoys awareness, and there's me. But that isn't our experience. Our experience is that there is one awareful being, which is me, you know, because of which the thought is known. Right? And so the thought arises, it is known. That's the experience. The thought arises, it is known. Next thought arises, it is known. Next thought arises, it is known. Why is it known? We'll say, well, because of the sattva. There is no thought that is not known, because its very nature is of the sattva material, reflects consciousness. But there's another thing to note about it, is that every thought comes and goes, and it comes and goes, and it comes and goes. The thoughts are very fluid, you know. The conscious being, the consciousness itself, is not coming and going. That's why it's the steady one. Your being, the luminary, is the steady one. Now the question is the steady one, this luminary, the conscious being, because of which this thought is known, what do we mean? What is it doing? Is it a knower? Are you a knower? You, the conscious being? You know, and if you are a knower, what is it that is performing that function of knowing? Because in terms of your body and your mind and your sense organs, we can answer that question easily. Because I have eyes, I can see. It's my eyes, this instrument, my eyes, that are responsible for my being able to see color. Yeah? So I have an instrument there. But the eyes themselves can be blinded and not functioning. And then I'm illuminating eyes that don't work. But the luminary is still there. The eyes aren't there. The instrument isn't there. But the luminary is there, coming up against a barrier of non-working eyes. It's the same with the mind, you know. The mind, as long as the mind is there, I illuminate. But from the standpoint of the mind, I can account for my experience as a thinker, a knower, a feeler, you know, a hearer. I can say my mind, using my sense organs, becomes a knower of all of this, of all of these experiences. So this knowership is easily accounted for in terms of the mind and the sense organs. You see that? And we do. It's just in samsara. We talk about it all the time. But the mind, because it also is known. You know? What is the nature of the consciousness that allows it to be known? Is it a knower? Is the conscious being a knower of the mind? Is it performing a function? Like I can say my mind is performing a function. My sense organs are performing a function to know. Is consciousness performing a function to know? You know? Because it could say, does it say, like, I think I'll know this thought. Let me turn my attention over here. Is it doing any type of a function? In fact, when you sit in meditation or you've done some japa, and you just recognize your own, your mind can differentiate its known nature from me, the conscious being, because of which it is known. And then you ask yourself, am I, the conscious being, my own self, the me, because of which this mind is known to me, right, and which is coming and going, am I doing anything? Am I doing a function? Am I doing an act of knowing? Or am I just being, and what is the nature of that being? So say we ask ourselves that, then we might say, well, actually my experience is, if I were to try to define my experience, is that I simply am a conscious being. I simply am a conscious being, and I'm not doing anything. I'm always exactly the same. I'm not changing. I'm not focusing. I'm not directing my attention. I simply am me, the conscious being, the chit. And these things, these vrittis, come and go in the conscious being that I am. Okay, now, if you can get to that place where you recognize that, because that really is just a discernment of your experience. You can say, no, I'm actually not doing anything. And now if you think about it just logically, if you were to do that see or seeing differentiation and just remove from the consciousness from you the things that were coming and going in your experience, if you remove the things that can that actually come and go in your experience, that would be the removal of any objectified experience. Any objectified experience, any vritti, any perception at all is something that comes and goes in you. Now, that's actually a very important thing, because if all of these things come and go in you, and you are not coming and going, right? And you just remain, then there's no relationship between you, no real intrinsic relationship between you and the experience that has just left. And in the world, we'd say, well, that's true. You left, I'm still here. So there's no real relationship. What about your mind? This thought came and went. It's gone, I'm still here. What's the relationship then? No. Okay, so if I am not doing anything, then the question is, am I a knower? Am I a knower? Or am I simply knowledge? Am I a knower, or am I the knowledge, you know, which everything enjoys that comes in my wake? So this thought comes, it is known. 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 Is the knownness coming and going? Or is the thought coming and going? That's the thing. The knownness never comes and goes. The knownness is just the knownness of the thought doesn't belong to the thought. That's the viveka. The knownness of the thought doesn't belong to the thought. The knownness of the thought is the light, is the consciousness because of which the thought is known. And so thought comes and goes, thought comes and goes, thought comes and goes. What is the constant is just the knownness of awareness itself. That's why they say that shit, consciousness. Consciousness alone really is the vidya. That is the knowledge, and that is whole and complete in itself. We superimpose that and think that the object which is coming and going has something to do with that knowledge. And then we come in and say, and I know that. So that's the false bifurcation that takes place, where the ahankara, the I notion now, is identified with the conscious aspect of the vritti. Right? Because the thought modification comes and goes in consciousness. You know? And so I have to say, I am the knower of the object. Of course, because I'm identified with myself as this body, mind, sense organs. And I have an eyes and mind. So I am the knower, the conscious being, and these are the objects which are known. But when we get into a real analysis of it, actually, there is no experience of a knower. There is only the experience of known. All the way. For instance, if I say the painting is known, the space is known, this body is known. Now these are all vrittis, right? This painting, vritti, okay, this is known. Right now I'm looking, this is known. Okay, this body is known. My sense organs, I become aware, they are known. The mind itself, whatever thought I'm thinking, whatever mood or emotion is there, that is known. And then what about me, the conscious being? I am known. Where is the knower to be found other than really an illusion? It's an illusory concept. The ahankara itself, the I notion, which is really the product in Vedanta, that is the very product of avidya, product of ignorance, that I notion, which comes and identifies with the upadi, with the body, mind, sense organs, especially here with the mind. And then identifying with the mind, I am this, body, mind, sense organs, who am a conscious being, who is a knower, a thinker, a feeler, a perceiver, a hearer, that I'm identifying with all these sense organs in the mind, taking them to be the conscious being who now is the perceiver of things that I'm not identified with. But in fact, what is happening is that every experience that I have, which is always going to be in the form of a vritti, of a thought modification, right, because that is my window. The mind is the window toward things that are away from me, so to speak. What is happening is we have consciousness, the conscious being, and a vritti rising in that conscious being. When the vritti rises, the vritti is known. There is no reason to take myself to be a knower at all. I am just the knowledge in which the vritti rises. When the vritti is there, the knowledge is super. The knowledge, which is me, which is consciousness, it's not different than consciousness, is superimposed upon the vritti, on the thought modification. When it's superimposed upon the thought modification, then there's a subject-object differentiation that takes place, because I'm not going to identify with something I'm looking at. I'm only going to identify myself as a conscious being, right? And so if the conscious being is superimposed on the mind, then I call myself the knower, and that's the known. Mm-hmm. But in fact, there is no knower known in reality. There's just consciousness, me, which is changeless, and the vritti, which is illumined, you know? So with that type of analysis, you try to find a knower. There isn't one. There can't be one, because there is nothing that isn't known in your experience, right? Including consciousness itself. The me is known. It's self-evident. In fact, I am the only thing that is self-evident. Everything rises into self-evident me, like the self-evident lamp, right? Everything is known because of the lamp. Everything here is known because of the conscious me. And even a thought like, I am a knower, that also is illumined. It's also itself requires to be known. Right? I am a knower, that's the ahankar. I am a doer. This is a vritti, it's a vritti. You have a vritti of knowing the painting, and you have another vritti that comes and says, I know the painting. Right? So all of these vrittis are taking place in the knowledge that you can never get away from. That's why they say this chit, consciousness alone, right, is the knowledge, and that is vilasanti. Vilasanti means it shines. It is self-evident. You know, it's not non-existent. It's not a perception. Perceptions take place in me who am knowledge. It's also not a non-perception in deep sleep, right? Consciousness illumines that non-perception, but in the important thing for understanding the nidra, the deep sleep, why it's so really important in your viveka and your analysis, is because in deep sleep, the seer-seeing relationship is not there. It doesn't exist. If it doesn't exist, it can't be you. What is you, right, the experience of your being can't go away unless you go away. See, that's actually a very powerful thing to contemplate on. The self-experience of you cannot go away unless you go away. Right? If it's intrinsic to you, you can't get rid of it. You can get rid of knowership. You can't get rid of the self-evident being, but you can get rid of the subject-object duality. The knowership doesn't belong to you. Those functions of knower known belong to the upadis. Otherwise, if that weren't so, in terms of Vedanta, which the self that I am is the self of all beings, that would be impossible. If the self that I am is the self of all beings, for some of you, I might be making a jump now, but it's the thing we've been working with. So if I'm the self of all beings, means myself then is yourself. You know, but if I am a knower, then I should know your mind and your mind and your mind as well as my mind. You know? And if the self that I am is the self of Ishwara, then I should be, you know, a sarvajna. I should be omniscient. I should know everything. Because if if the Atma, the Atma itself is a knower, and the Atma is Ishwara, the Atma is Brahman, right? And from the standpoint of Ishwara, the entire creation is known, as, you know, manifest, infinite manifest knowledge, as the whole Ishwara Upadhi, the Ishwara manifestation, which is known. You know, then if the Atma is a knower and I am that Atma, which is Brahman, then it shouldn't just, that omniscience shouldn't just belong to Ishwara. And your experience should just belong to you. It should belong to me also. Right? Because I am the knower. The Atma is the knower. The Atma is not the knower. You need a mind and sense organs, or you need to be identified with a whole Maya Upadhi that is, you know, is pervaded by Sattva. And that's Ishwara, and you all are part of Ishwara with limited minds. And so there's limited knowership, limited perception, limited sphere of experience. But the Atma is not a knower. It is me, a very conscious being. You have to do this contemplation, the japa, or however you do it. Just ask yourself, am I a knower? Am I doing anything? Like right now, at this moment, just focus on your own presence, your own being. You're not doing anything. But you are the very self that is the center of everything, you know? But you yourself aren't doing anything. You're not looking around knowing and, oh, look at what's going on here and there. You are just very simply, you know, abiding as the very truth of the very self of all of the experience that you're having. But you yourself aren't doing anything. You're not engaged in anything. And you're always exactly the same. That's why as this viveka, this differentiation starts to become more and more clear. Mm-hmm. Your being starts to, that your own nature, having differentiated yourself from all of these coming and going experiences, comes more to the forefront. Not that there's any physical movement, but there's a recognition on the part of the mind of the very conscious being, you know, which is the very self of the mind, but which is not performing any type of function at all, other than being the knowledge, you know, the changeless knowledge which the mind enjoys. And it enjoys it, bifurcates that knowledge in terms of knower and known, because I have to be somewhere in that mix. Right? It's talking from the standpoint of the jiva. Right? That's why we say, you know, the ahankara, this I notion, is born of jnana, the beginningless ignorance. That's what allows for this ahankara. And it's that beginningless ignorance that has to be removed. And in removing it, what happens is that the aham, the I, aham means I, the aham, instead of being ahankara, means a notional I that has been superimposed upon your experience, rests nicely with you, right? Which in you who are changeless and free and whole and complete, you who can't make yourself any better than you are, and you can't take away from yourself either. That being, the being that you are, is whole and complete, and nothing can touch you in any way. But this being has to be recognized. It can't be a belief. You know, the Upanishads say that, you know, you are free and nothing can touch you in any way. Go be happy. Yeah. That doesn't work. You have to recognize that in fact is who you are. Nothing can do anything. No one can do anything about it. There's ignorance. When the ignorance is removed, that is over. You know, it's over. But you know, Swamiji tells this. You know, the Swamiji tells stories about this overness. You know, his favorite. One of his favorite stories is, you know, the tenth man story, where the ten boys, you know, the ten boys cross the river. One of the boys is the guide. They've been on a long hike. They decided to cross this river, and it's a kind of a difficult river, a little bit scary. But he feels we can do it. You know, we can do it. So he says, let's just keep an eye out for each other. And they make it all the way across. And being the responsible boy that he is, when they get to the other side, he gathers everybody, you know, and counts them. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9. He goes, oh, where's the tenth man? goes 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. Oh, where is he? And then the other boys start looking around, and slowly the pressure mounts and the worry mounts because, you know, they're only getting the 9 count. And so the big fear starts to develop that one of us didn't make it across the river. One of the boys may have drowned in the river, and so he sends all of the boys out looking. And some guy, some wise man, old sadhu sitting on the banks, sees, you know, how anxious these boys are, how concerned they are, you know. And so he goes up and asks the leader, you know, what has happened? What's wrong? You know, he seems so distraught. And he said, well, there were 10 of us, you know, and we crossed this river, and now there's only 9. You know, we think one of us is drowned in the river, and we can't find him anywhere. And some boys at Randbeck's, now they're all, the boys are coming and gathering. And the old man kind of looks at the group, and he said, how many did you say there were? He said, there were 10 of us, and now there's only 9. And the old man says, I see. He said, I can show you the 10th man. He said, well, where? And as soon as he said that, old man said, you know, don't worry, I can show you the 10th man, I know where he is. The boys all start being relieved because they have a savior there that's going to get the 10th man, you know. But that relief, that faith is okay, it's a relief, but it doesn't really solve the problem. Solving the problem is actually finding the 10th man, mm-hmm. not knowing that the 10th man is there to be found. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. It's not good enough. And so the old man says, just line your boys up. And the fellow, the leader, said, what? Line your boys up. So he did. He said, count your boys. He said, I've counted so many times. You know, the guy says, count. And this boy had enough shraddha, you know, kind of a faith in the old man and hope, to go ahead and count. He got him 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9. And he looks at the old man, kind of disappointed, like, I told you so.
Still not there.
I told you so. And the old man says, 10, you're the 10th man. Okay. When he said that, he had already eliminated every possibility. The 9 had been eliminated, and when he said 10, that boy couldn't do anything except feel kind of embarrassed and say, oh, I'm the 10th man. Okay, but now, when Swamiji tells the story, between the time between recognizing that the 10th man is missing and the old man coming and saying, you are the 10th man, a lot has happened. Like, the boy was very, very distraught, and he went to a tree and banged his head on the tree, you know, and had a big, you know, cut, you know, and tried to do all kinds of things. One Swamiji said he decided he would change his diet and eat. He would change his diet, and then he would, you know, eat some of these. Swamiji said he'd eat, you know, some of these sprouts, some of these bean sprouts, and then he would eat some. He tried just brown rice and bean sprouts, and you know, hoping that somehow that kind of tapas would bring back the 10th man. And then he would try to meditate, and he would do some pranayama and all kinds of things to bring back that 10th man, you know. But nothing worked, and finally the old man came and told him, you are the 10th man. But by that time he was very thin. And he had a cut on his head, you know. And so even though he recognized, you know, I am the 10th man, there's still some healing to do. That was the idea. There's still some even healing to do, you know. And then maybe he was so traumatized that he'd have to go back to the old sadhu, you know, and say, how was that I'm the 10th man? I'm sorry, just tell me again. How was that? You know, because it was so awful, you know. It was so awful. I'm so traumatized by it that I can't quite remember what you said, even though I know it's true, but could you tell me again? And so I tell him a few times, you know, maybe 9 times, like in the Chandogya Upanishad, Shweta Ketu has to go to his father 9 times to ask him, tell me one more time. Tell me one more time. She asked him 9 times. And then he, that's enough. He understands. So when we say, you know, once you know, you know. That is true. Once you know, you know. But your mind still, you know, has some emotional lifetime. Because the trauma is so much. You know, because you go from, just imagine, even though it's a beginningless situation, you go from spending beginningless lifetimes of taking yourself as a jiva who's bound by dharma and adharma, bound by birth and death, bound by, you know, pleasure and pain, punya and papa, all of these things. You know, it's really hard. Life is hard. You know, if we're trying to get out of it what it doesn't really have to give, it never works. I want to be whole and complete and full, you know, and I want you to make me that way, or I want this situation to give me that, or this person to give me that wholeness and completeness, or I want to be treated in a certain way so then I can feel like I'm whole and complete. You know, it's very complicated what we're asking the creation to do, and not, it's complicated, but even if it were simple, the creation would still have to say, if it could talk to you, it would say, I'm sorry. I'm not able to give those things. You know, I can only give you, you know, momentary experiences, but I can't give you anything lasting, because nothing about me is constant or stable like that, so it's not possible for me to do that, you know. That's the reality of it. And yet I'm looking for that wholeness. I want more and more and more knowledge, and then, you know, more and more and more knowledge where I actually am the knowledge that I'm seeking. Literally, the knowledge itself is experiential as my own self-evident being. That is the experience of knowledge. I superimpose that self-evident knowledge onto the creation. And then I try to, okay, now I know this, now I know this, now I know this. Whereas in fact, the knowledge, the knowing, that experience is the constant nature of me. You know? And so I already am full in terms of knowledge. I already am full and complete in terms of being. For the yourself, there is no coming and going of being, you know, of your isness. Everything else is coming and going except for you. You're never coming and going. You're the stable one there. And so even in terms of the wholeness or the ananda, I am the very ananda that I seek. That's for another day. But you know, I'm the wholeness that I'm the fullness that I seek. Nothing ever happens to me. There's nothing more dear than me. But I have to have that discrimination to unwind all of these projections, these superimpositions of me onto a finite changing world, whether it be everything that I'm perceiving outside of my body, or the finite, very changing body, the finite changing sense organs, the finite changing mind, the finite changing ahankar. There isn't anything that's not, you know, subject to birth and death. That's the reality. And so I superimpose what is not subject to birth and death on what is subject to birth and death. Well, that's a losing situation, you know. Because this gets to be, but the being which it gets is made finite. Not really. But, you know, if I'm walking along and I mistake a rope for a snake, my emotional life is on the snake, centered on the snake, not the rope. And so if I superimpose me, who I am, on something which is finite and changing, then my emotional life is centered on that, not on the reality of who I am. That's why knowledge is so powerful and ignorance is so powerful. Ignorance is amazing in its power because the ignorant concept controls me, my emotional life. And the knowledge controls me also, my emotional life. You know? I would rather have knowledge than ignorance, because if you have knowledge, you know, you're dealing with reality as it is. That's what we mean by knowledge. You're dealing with yourself as you are. That's a much better situation. Okay. Mm-hmm. Okay. So, Okay, that's enough. We'll do the next verse. Next verse is related, but well, you know, for Ramana, all the verses are very related. Mm-hmm. You know, it's like a bee circling around very closely to a little honey flower. Mm-hmm. Okay, let's take a moment. Om Purnamada Purnamidam Purnat Purnamadachate Purnasya Purnamadaya Purnameva Vasishyate Om Shanti 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 Hari Om Shri Gurubhyo Namaha Hari Om. Hi Shweta, hi Kriyananda Devi, hi Virginia, hi Jagadish, hi Trisha, hi Didya, hi Susan. So, we're leaving in the morning, early morning, off to India.
Thank you for having class tonight.
Huh?
It was wonderful, class tonight, thank you for having it tonight.
Oh yeah,
you're welcome. Leaving so early tomorrow. Okay.
That's
well, we can all go together.
Let's all go.
You know, it seems so simple and so true, and yet not known. It's just...
You know, the thing is about that, what's so amazing is that you both know and you don't know. Because you are the self. And so that you do recognize and take for granted, in fact, your own being. Your own being. I am, I exist, I'm a conscious being. It's absolutely taken for granted, and it's constant. And that is the self that is Brahman. It's not some other Brahman. That is Brahman. But the problem is that it is Brahman isn't known. So the conscious, because your consciousness, the conscious being that you are, is superimposed on the body and mind, sense organs, all of this. You take yourself to be finite, a finite changing being. You know, and the mind is so tumultuous because we're trying to make the world be something that it's not, to satisfy me in a way that it's not able to do. You know, that there's all this... all of this ignorance around the specific nature of myself. What we say in Sanskrit, there's samanya jnana, just the general recognition of me. That's experience. It's experiential. I'm a conscious being. That self-experience is there. It's self-evident, self-effulgent, in fact. But what is the actual nature of me, that it's the self of the whole, that's the truth of the whole creation, that isn't known, you know. So you have this general recognition, samanya jnanam, without any what we call vishesha jnanam, the particular actual nature of me, of this experience. That's why you can say, well, I know I am now, but what happens when this body dies? That's a big thing not to know. That I'm here, I know. That I'm a conscious being, I know, but I don't know what happens to me when the body dies. I know I'm here, but and that you're here, but I don't know what is the relationship of me to you. I don't know that. for me to God, to Ishwar. I'm a conscious being. I assume Ishwar is a conscious being, or there's either no Ishwar. Ishwar is a conscious being. Lord is a conscious being. But what is that consciousness in relationship to my consciousness? So, consciousness, the conscious being, is known, but what it is not known. Which it's interesting when you think of gaining knowledge, because you're gaining knowledge, you're not gaining a new experience, you're gaining a recognition of the experience me, the self-evident me that is already here. Whereas when we think of gaining knowledge, we think first we have to get the object, have an experience of the object, and then learn about the object. But first we have to get the experience of the object. But here you don't get the experience. The experience of the self is already here.
So there's nothing new.
There's nothing new to be gained. However, there's something, there's in the removal of ignorance, there's a totally different orientation. Mm. And that is new. But the self experience is more like, oh, you mean me? I am whole, I am complete, I am the self in all things. This me that I've always taken to be finite and subject to birth and death. That's a different, whole different way of knowing, which is why, unless this is really made very clear, we want to first experience the self and then know it. Experience it as an object to come into the, you know, like meditate and then have through the mind reach this new experience that is then we realize is a self. That's very misleading. But that's how we know about knowledge. That's what we know about knowledge. The difference, the difference here though is that I'm already here. So now it's a matter of viveka, discrimination. It's a matter of recognition of who I am versus what this is. But the experience, self-experience, is already there. It just has to be understood now. That's why viveka, this discrimination, is so important.
Now, is it a differentiation between knownness and Ishvara? Or is it just in the teaching itself, you identify the Ishvara in different ways to make the point?
I would say that the knownness that Ishvara enjoys in terms of the whole creation is the exact knownness, same one same knownness that you are in reference to a limited vritti. Mm-hmm. The knownness there's only one non-dual conscious being, which is the vidya. Whether that conscious being is the conscious being which is Ishvara, which is the jiva. Ishvara, when we say the difference between Ishvara and the jiva, has to do with what we call the upadi, the conditioning adjunct. So for Ishvara, the infinite manifest knowledge, right, takes place in consciousness. For the jiva is part of that infinite manifest knowledge, like a wave in an ocean, right? And so for the jiva, the body, mind, sense organs are all limited. My mind is not your mind, right? But all of us are part and parcel of one infinite manifest knowledge that we call Ishvara, that has one self, which is, when you say I am, you're referring to the self, which is the self of Ishvara. If Ishvara were to say I am, it's referring to that one self, me. There's only one me.
But we don't share that knownness. We don't share that consciousness.
You are that consciousness. You don't share it. You are it.
And it's one unto itself, then.
It's only one. Only one. It doesn't have time. It doesn't have space. Consciousness isn't an object in time and space. Like, if I ask you to, or you just think of your dream. When you have a dream at night, the time and space come with the dream, right? And they go with the dream too. That has nothing to do. You are not affected by the time and space that belongs to the dream. And in the same way, your consciousness is not affected or has really nothing. Does not expand or shrink or have anything to do with the time and space of the universe, except other than it is the very being that that time-space projection of the universe enjoys. It's the self of the whole projection, but itself isn't subject to time and space. And again, when you're just contemplating and just being with you, just being with your own nature, your mind, have your mind ask yourself, you know, what size am I? Am I big? Am I small? Am I tall? Or, you know, what color am I? What sex am I? All of these questions belong to samsara. They belong to they exist within the creation. But I'm not a size, I'm not a color, I'm not an age. How old am I? You ask awareness, how old am I? I'm changeless. There's no age. And all of these things, you know, are objects that exist within the creation. Like, it's nice to just use your imagination. Like, I like to imagine a meadow with people in the meadow and the trees and the grass and the sun. And do your imagination and let activities happen within that imagination. But all of the time, space, the objects, the activity, all of it belong to this one whole imagination that manifests from you, is sustained by you, and resolves into you. And you are the changeless substrate reality of the whole thing. Even substrate means there's something on top of it, so it doesn't. So it's not the snake is not lying on top of the rope, you know. So the better word we use is adhishtana. The adhishtana means that which, because of which, this illusion or this myth, whatever is we call mitya, which is totally dependent on it for its being, is there. Yeah. And so I am the adhishtana. I am the one because of whom, you know, this imagination enjoys being, enjoys consciousness. No. But I'm the truth of that being. I am the being that it enjoys. I am the consciousness that it enjoys. It itself, you know, has no being apart from that. So if you play with your imagination or analyzing your dreams, you can, that those are good examples to help you understand the sun on a larger scale. The relationship.
You say that will is connected to the I-thought?
To the buddhi and to the intellect and the I-thought, yeah. And there is such a thing as will. Are you talking about free will or
if you will something, I'm going to build a house.
Mm-hmm.
And you build a house.
It starts with that thought, right? Mm-hmm. And you have to have that initial thought. Of course, you could say, I'm going to build a house and then not build it.
Right.
Yeah. But to build the house, you have to have that thought. And the thought has to have some comma, some desire behind it.
Desire.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Otherwise, why would you build it?
Right.
Yeah. Yeah.
So. I've heard this. I'm trying to say it correctly, but I feel like it just keeps running through my head as you're talking. So.
Yeah.
It's like we see the world, like we think that the world exists because it's there, and then we see it. This is something about, but that the world exists because we. Oh God, I wish I've tried to say this to you before. It's like the world exists because we see it, not because it's there, or something. And it feels like on the edge of.
That sounds like kind of a solipsism. Solipsism means the world is there because kind of it's my projection. That's so, you know, it's not really here. You're all just my projection. So this creation that I'm experiencing is centered on me. Now, actually, that's true if the me is the self of all beings. But when with solipsism, the me. There's probably a lot of different versions of solipsism, so anyway, the one I'm familiar with, that all of this is my projection. I'm the jiva. As a jiva, as an individual, I'm taking everything that I'm experiencing just as my projection. Whereas Vedanta doesn't accept that at all. It's that there's one really non-dual self from which this whole maya creation comes, you know? And the self is the self of the entire creation. Now, within this creation, there are jivas, individuals. And then these individuals can project upon the more objective creation. You know, like I can project a snake on a rope and mistake things and create kind of what we call jiva srishti. Jiva srishti means the creation of the jiva, of the individual, upon the Ishwara srishti. Ishwara's creation, the objective manifestation, the infinite manifestation of knowledge, as Swamiji will say. And so you are part of that infinite projection, and then because you have a mind and sense organs, you can yourself project upon that objective projection of Ishwara. But you as a jiva are one part of the projection.
Mm-hmm.
You're not the projector of it, you know, but you can project upon it. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm.
So that's the Vedanta.
I also heard it as something like everything exists as a potentiality, and then only when we put our observation on it is there. Is that the same thing?
I don't know quite what that means.
In other words, unless our observation is there, nothing exists without it.
I don't think we'd accept that because there's a shared reality that we call the Ishwara Srishti.
Mm.
Yeah. And so, otherwise, how can we function without a shared reality? Mm-hmm. So that would be, I don't think, accepted. Or it would be, we'd have to get a lot of clarity on what is actually meant by that.
I also wonder about, I know we had this conversation before, but it's like, that you realize, you know, you're whole and complete and you're the awareness, but also you don't deny that there is ignorance. Is that right? I mean, you also want to be aware that we live in the reality of Maya. Is that right? This is like the two levels. When you do inquiry, how much do you go into one or the other?
You know, this world of experience is here. If you gain have self-knowledge, this world of experience is still here,
mm-hmm.
you know? And so, but the thing is that your orientation toward it is much different. Because for a number of reasons, one, this isn't, as Ishwara, this is an intelligent creation, which has yourself, the self, which you are, as its being. So this creation is not somebody else's creation, you know. This is your being. This whole creation is your being, and you see that and you understand it. And then on top of that, the ananda fullness that you tried to get from the creation, that's over, right? Because that is just an illusion. The basic illusion is that everybody has, not just one or two. And this is a worldwide illusion. That's why it works so well. We're all captured by it. But it's that we are all run after fulfilling a desire because I want this so that I can be happy. That's what a desire is. And so the thing is when we do fulfill a desire, even though there can be a lot of stress and strain along the way, those moments when I do fulfill a desire, at that moment, mm-hmm. I become desireless.
Mm-hmm.
And in that moment, I have just a beautiful shantavritti. I don't want anything. I have a very peaceful, clear, clean, like the clear water bucket reflecting the sun. And so now I do feel happy. Because when the mind is quiet, it reflects the nature of the self in a way that it enjoys a happiness, which belongs to the vritti. But that's all I know. I don't have any knowledge of my own wholeness that is abiding there in all vrittis, even unhappy vrittis. It doesn't make any difference. That wholeness is there as its right being. That needs to be discerned. But for somebody who doesn't have knowledge, you just run after fulfilling desires so that you can have those moments of desirelessness, which then, like a clear water bucket reflecting the sun, you know, feel totally resonant with me, you know? And so that's what we do. But the problem is that I think that I'm gaining that because of you. You're giving me that. You know, but actually what happens is the one that I thought was giving it to me later becomes an object of hatred or dislike, or somebody that's totally, you know, I could care less about. They have nothing to do with my Ananda. So it's all a total illusion.
And I wonder when you inquire, so when you talk about Nitya, so I'm aware of what you just talked about, but when you inquire in, so do you at all focus on Mitya itself, or is it more like that you kind of reflect on your own whole and complete nature, and where does Mitya come in? Because at one point I remember I said to you, like, you know, walking around the lake or something, saying I'm whole and complete, and I think you said something, if I recall it right, it's like I'm this and I'm free of this.
Yeah.
You know,
that's true also, yeah.
Where you take both levels in account, is
it
right?
But see, this is no longer threatening. This is Ishwara. See, once I don't need Ishwara to be a particular way so that I can be whole and complete, then I can appreciate the creation. I can appreciate you as you are, because I don't require you to be a particular way, and then I can really enjoy Ishwara, actually. When the jiva pops in, it's, I need this to be like this, and I need this to be like that, you have to be like that, and this has to be like that. And then I can relax. You know, it's a big job, and then you have to try to keep it that way. You know? But, so it's not at all a dismissal of the creation, it's a recognition of the creation as Ishwara, which is very different.
Mm-hmm.
You know? And so then I'm free to engage. I'm free to love you and to engage with you, and you can, if you leave, it's all right. I won't be destroyed, you know, because myself doesn't leave. The source of Ananda doesn't leave, and I can let you be as you are. That's why people love to be around a saint. I was using Swamiji as an example, because you don't feel threatened. You're fine. If you have a problem, he'll help. That's all. But he doesn't require you to be something, you know, so that he can be happy, you know, and so then he can actually, he can kind of relax, and there's somebody there that will help you, you know, because he doesn't have an investment in you being a particular way so that he can be happy, right? So it's a wonderful thing to experience that level of non-judgmentalness.
Mm-hmm.
And an acceptance, and your nature actually is love, really. I mean, it's its own type of love, the nature of yourself. And so when you're with somebody who's not pressuring you to be something else at all, then you get to kind of bask in that. So you want to get back? Yeah. Did you figure out something to do with these?
What's up? I'm listening to something.
Really? Do you have stuff?
Yeah,
I'm good. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Anyway, does that make sense?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, it also seems like it's a balance of identity. How strong does this identity have to be for yourself, as opposed to finding yourself in the parties or the world?
Well,
I mean,
when you're kind of identified and everything's going fine, then no problem.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. But the thing is, it doesn't go fine for very long. There's always something comes in. There's no reason, but even that question is nonsensical, in the sense that once you know you, why are you even wanting to know yourself? You want to know yourself so that you can be free, because that is your nature, really. And then being free, then you can experience this world. But then you're kind of asking, well, is it okay to not be free sometimes? And well, no, it isn't. That's why when you're feeling not free, that is a sadhana for you. It's not something you don't condemn yourself. There's nothing to condemn there.
Hmm.
It's just that the mind hasn't assimilated in that area. So that's a sadhana. That's something to work out. Because it's creating suffering. You know, so when suffering is being created, then we have to be with that and work with it. And you work with it in the light of your knowledge and also your psychology skills, your inner child work, and all of the things, you know, that we're learning.
It seems like that the Yeah, Vijaya mind, I mean that the mind that we use to analyze and understand things seems to have is trying over and over to attempt to bring together the individualized self with the universal self, if one wants to maybe call it that. And it's just kind of try to bring them together and make them one, but they actually will always be two visions, but they have to just... I kind of see it more, I just want to get your feedback on that. It looks like Vedanta is actually trying to bring these two into kind of proper relationship with each other, instead of just kind of using the mind to just realize absolute reality by trying to consume the relative reality, and that, you know, for lack of better words. Do you understand what I mean? It's like kind of trying to bring two things together that actually will always exist as two, but it's just that there needs to be an understanding that needs to grow in between those two, as a jiva and the Ishvara, for example.
Well, I don't know. I wouldn't quite use that language.
Okay.
I would say that the self that you are, the conscious being, is the conscious being which Ishvara is. So there's no two. It's not bringing an individualized self with a infinite self together. There's only one infinite self, and your task is to recognize that fact, that the self, that the conscious being that you are, is the conscious being which is the self of the whole creation. Because at one level. On another level, this body, mind, sense organs complex that we name, you know, is part and parcel of Ishvara, like a wave is part of an ocean, right? And so it has individuality, but the individuality belongs to and part of the total. It's not separate. It's it's the part to the whole. That's the relationship. Mm-hmm. And so with that understanding, then you can realize that this life, this body, mind, sense organs, is part of a bigger story. You know, it's not you carving out your story in an inert creation. It's in fact the story of your life is part of Ishvara's story. You know, and that allows you to kind of, as you start to kind of relax into that, you know, then you can respond to your life, the life that really is Bhagavan, is really Ishvara's life in a sense, you know, the life that's unfolding for you. This is your life. And so then you can receive the life as it's being given to you, instead of thinking that you're creating your life. You know, in fact, that really, I don't think that's true at all. I think that the life from birth to death unfolds, and that you find yourself in this experience and the next experience, and you're, you know, responding to it and living within it. But say if you start understanding it that way, you can really relax, you know, and respond dharmically until that's not a question. You respond with dharma and with that karma yoga buddhi, taking everything as this prasad, to the life that's been given, you know, and enjoy this life. You have many, many lives. This one, this is your life now. This is the life you've been given. So you don't need somebody else's life. Yeah, this is your life and the whole creation, you know, the whole prarabdha karma that brought you into this life and will take you through to your death is meant for you. And so if you're satisfied with your life, it's easy because you fit into your slot, right? You're already in your slot. You know, the whole universe just supports that. It's only when we see, oh, the Joneses over here, I like their slot better. You know? And that gets very, you know, complex and disappointing, frustrating, you know, because you're trying to live out somebody else's life instead of really appreciating the incredible life that you have.
But it seems to me, even with this Ishvara's projection, even if you understand that, there's still a sense of individuality. That's part of the projection, even though you have knowledge that that's not
that's
true.
Well, the individuality is that this body is an individual body. That body is an individual body. You know, that's true. But they're all part of a whole. Mm-hmm. Right? Just like this wave is different than this wave and this wave, but all of these waves are held by the ocean and the laws of the ocean. And so each individual thing, I mean, all the insects, all beings, and all of the creatures that there are, and the whole universe itself is held together by an infinite structure of laws that we call, you know, the whole, that make this a whole entity. Yeah. And your body and mind and life is part of that.
But that's kind of a fried individuality, right? I mean, even though the individuality is experienced, it's not, it doesn't contain me. It's...
Yeah, that's the way to say it, is that you recognize that this is part and parcel of Ishwara. You know? And the self of the self of Ishwara, that all that's really here is Ishwara. Including this body, mind, sense organs.
And including the sense of individuality also.
Yeah.
So it's kind of the wave expanding its awareness, instead of just being a wave, actually recognizing it's the ocean. But it still remains also...
It still remains also a wave that recognizes it's a part of the ocean, and on one level, the wave is a part of the ocean, as are all of the waves. Mm. And on another what level, it is the ocean, because what is the ocean but water? And what is the wave but water?
So there isn't really a wave, ultimately. Not even a wave.
You know what? Ultimately, there's only consciousness. Mm-hmm. It's like if you do the clay pot. Is there clay and a pot? Does the pot... Mm. Is there anything about the pot that is not clay? That's such a mitya. Mm-hmm. So ultimately, there's only clay there. But of course, there's a pot, right? So ultimately, there's only consciousness that's it, which is me, the conscious self that I am. Ultimately, that's all that is here. But then there's all this. All right, let's call it a night. Yeah, thanks. It'd be wonderful to spend some time with someone. I just sent out everybody an email, but